Welcome to the Low Carb MD Podcast, where we seek progress, not perfection.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Low Carb MD Podcast. Today, we're super excited to have Joy Kitty with us. She's a low carb, high fat dietitian. It even says that on her website, and it hasn't been shut down yet because she's showing some huge benefits. Tro, do you want to add something?
Yeah, absolutely. Joy, I'm so happy that you've come on the show with us. I've been following you on Twitter and I've been following your blog for a very, very long time. I can say I've personally related to your story, and I know many of my patients who follow you online and follow your recipes and follow your kind of your journey, and you've inspired many people. So I'm so happy to have you here. And one thing that I think is a little, something that most people might not know is, as people know and our listeners know, you know, Jason Fung and Megan Ramos are kind of part of this podcast, and he had an impact on you in getting your clinic set up. So I want to hear, you know, kind of all about your story. I'm so happy to have you here, and super humbled that you've come on.
Well, thank you very much. Jason was amazing. I reached out to him about almost 5 years ago now, when a girlfriend of mine who is a retired physician came to speak to me because I'm a dietitian, and she was wanting to put her husband on a low carb diet to address some of his metabolic issues and wanted to know what I thought. And I didn't have any thoughts because I hadn't really considered a low carb diet since back in the days of Atkins. And I'm old enough to remember it when it came out the first time. So she had been reading Dr. Fung's blogs at that point. He had been blogging for about a year and a half, I think. And she was discussing some of his insights. And I was going, this makes so much sense. Like, we both learned this when we went to university. This is the physiology and the endocrinology that we all learned, and then we promptly chucked it out the window and taught Canada's Food Guide. Like, what's up with that? And so I committed to her that I'd read through his blogs, not realizing how long he had been blogging for at that point. And he always put links, live links, to the studies that he'd refer to. And being a research nerd, I click on all the links and read all the papers because I didn't know him from Adam. I wanted to know if what he said was what the study said. And it always was what the study said, and he's very good at reflecting what the data says and putting it in terms that people can understand. So once I finally realized I can't go back to practicing the way I was before, this was a life changer. This was a career direction changer. Now, keep in mind, at that point, I was a 200-pound dietitian, so...
And we've all been there, right, Brian, myself.
Yeah, I know. You're preaching to the choir here. Jason changed my life also, and hearing him, I remember being a total skeptic, thinking this guy's trying to sell something, and then I realized he's not selling something. And reached out to him, and he's been a huge mentor to anyone who listens to this podcast now.
Let me go through the IDM program with Megan way back at the beginning, and I picked his brain about macros, and he was working on his first book at that point. And he was very gracious. And so I took 3 months off my practice to rethink how I'm going to do it, because I couldn't go back to teaching what I was doing before. And with his help, I came up with a model that was largely based on how he did it, with my own kind of dietitian take on it. Because at that point in time, unlimited, you know, bacon and sausages and whipping cream didn't, I hadn't read enough to think that saturated fat might not be a problem. So I took a slightly more conservative approach at first. And over the years now, it's been like 4.5 years since I've been teaching it. And it will be 20 months, actually, it's 20 months next week that I'm doing it myself. I've incorporated ideas from Finian Volek and from Ted Naiman. And Ted Naiman, I know, has been a huge impact on Tro as well. So I've kind of picked up things here and there. But my first exposure to anything academically related to this was from Jason Fung. So I'm very grateful for his encouragement way back at the beginning.
Yeah, you've had great people you follow for sure.
I've got a research background. So unless somebody could quote me references and, the other person I have to mention is Gabor Erdozi from the lower insulin group. He's had a huge impact, even though he's not a clinician. His knowledge as a food scientist is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, so absolutely, 100% agree with all those names that, you know, I know Jason Fung has had an impact on all of us. Particularly, Brian, you've mentioned that in the past, how he really kind of changed the way you look at insulin. Joy, can you talk to us about kind of your own personal journey with obesity? You know, Brian and I have talked about our personal journeys, but
sure.
And how your personal journey from obesity, diabetes, and kind of resolving some of these issues through diet, how has it changed the way you practice? How has it changed the way you approach patients?
Sure. I'd love to tell that story because I think one of the things in telling the story on my webpage, in my blogs and posting pictures on Twitter and Facebook of me fat and then me now, and I haven't arrived, I've still got 15 pounds to go or there plus or minus, is that people relate to my story because various aspects relate to what individual people's struggles are. I'll tell the story from the beginning. It was March 5th, 2017, and I was sitting at my clinical desk, and I just didn't feel good. I couldn't say I felt sick. I didn't feel, you know, any particular symptoms. I just didn't feel well. And I went upstairs and got my blood pressure cuff, which I hadn't used in, probably 2 years. And took my blood pressure, and it was 199 over 100. And I went, that can't be. This has got to be broken. And I lay down on the bed and waited 5 or 10 minutes, took it again, and it was, 198 over 99. And I was going, oh, crap. That's a hypertensive emergency. Let me see what my blood sugar is. Now, I've been type 2 diabetic for 8 years at that point, or almost 8 years, and I hadn't taken my blood sugar in about 2 years either. So I opened a fresh package of strips. Now, talk about denial. This is a dietitian, right? Registered dietitian, master's degree. Talk about denial. I hadn't taken my blood pressure or my blood sugar in almost 2 years. So I took my blood sugar, opened a new set of strips, and it was 13.2.
Wow.
And I went, wow, if I go see my doctor with blood pressure like that and blood sugar like that, he's going to send me in an ambulance to the hospital.
That was a wake-up call, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. And I was like, I don't want to do that. Now, disclaimer, huge disclaimer, what I should have done was go to the doctor, let him give me all the meds he wanted to, then change my lifestyle and get off the meds. Because that would have been the safest approach, but I didn't. I was stubborn and I was in denial. And I decided at that point in time, after teaching low carb to my patients for 2.5 years, that day I was going to adopt a low carb lifestyle. And I did. And I have not looked back since.
I have a question. Sure. What was your diet like when you were at your worst right there? Were you following any guidelines or you're just kind of eating whatever you wanted? What were you at that point, at your starting point of the low carb?
What's ridiculous is for the most part, my diet was what everybody in my profession and most probably in your profession too, or don't understand how low carb works, would probably say is a really healthy diet. I ate whole grain bread, brown rice, lots of vegetables, lots of stir fries, lots of tofu. I steamed meat. I took fat off. I took the skin off chicken. The only, skin on something I ate was like on salmon because of the omega-3s. I hardly ate any red meat. I ate Canada's Food Guide for diabetics. I ate according to best clinical practice of Diabetes Canada. Now, I'm up here in Canada, so our guidelines are basically the same. Our food guide is essentially the same as your food guide, except we have a different shape to yeah. it. But it's pretty well the same.
Same type of thing, eating three meals and then snacks in between, that type of thing to keep the metabolism running and all that.
Each meal has to have 65 grams of carbohydrate and protein, and each snack has to have 45 grams of carbohydrate plus protein. So we're talking 300 grams of carbohydrate per day over six eating occasions, meals and snacks. And so I was doing everything I was supposed to. And actually, when I was pre-diabetic, I started eating that way. I used to not eat snacks, and I started eating that way and became diabetic. So
that's
I
funny.
Knew that this was not working. This was like, to continue to eat this way was absolute insanity. Like, this did not make sense.
You're telling my story. That's exactly what my experience was too.
Really?
I was following the guidelines. I was eating, you know, I'd have an apple and some almonds, and I would have this, and I was eating it. Mm-hmm. And then, I knew I couldn't skip lunch, so I'd shove something down because I was afraid I'd shut my metabolism and go into starvation yeah. mode.
And so, when you posted that, I laughed the other day when we were having that little interchange Twitter because that's exactly what I believed. And I ate that way because I'm going to slow my metabolism down and I'm going to go into starvation mode.
And that's what part is. We're causing the problem to get worse by making recommendations that are not based on science, it's based on feelings. And that's why, you know, I love your journey because it's very similar to mine. And I know Tro's was very similar also. So we're educated. There's a feeling that people who are obese are not smart and they're lazy and they sit around doing nothing. And I don't think all of us changed our character that one day. Right.
You know what's really amazing is I used to be very, very defensive at the beginning when I started posting as the low carb, high fat RD about people making disparaging comments about fat dietitians. And this was during the Tim Noakes and Gary Fetke witch trials, the McCarthy era of low carb. And lots of people had very negative things to say about dietitians because of the way, particularly Tim Noakes, how he was treated. And I would post and say, look, not all dietitians are like this. And there would be a lot of disparaging comments about fat dietitians. And I was very defensive about people making comments about fat dietitians because I was a fat dietitian.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah.
Now I look at obese people and I have an entirely different view because I've been there. And not everybody, very few people that I meet are obese because they want to be obese or because they're lazy or because they're stupid. So many people are legitimately trying to do what they've been told or read or heard is best. And, you know, I think it's a very small percentage of people who just thrown up their hands and say, whatever, I'll eat whatever. And, you know, end up becoming that much more metabolically unwell because they just don't care anymore.
Yeah, and that's who we're trying to reach with this podcast. That's why you're perfect. We're trying to reach doctors who say, you know, these guys are nuts. They haven't looked at the data. Well, we have looked at the data and we have experienced clinical and personal success. And so someone like you, who's a dietitian, who puts your career on the line really to make changes because you had to save your own life. And then you say, hey, this is working. Let me reach out to other people and try it with them and see if they have the same benefits. Exactly.
Actually,
my story.
No, actually, my story is reverse.
Yeah.
I was doing it for 2.5 years with my clients. I was blogging about it on my webpage, which is the LCHF-RD.com, little plug there. Under the Food for Thought tab are my academic articles, and they're in my Science Made Simple style. I like to take the academics of study and put them into language that people can understand. Because if it's in ivory towers that only doctors and registered dietitians with master's degrees or PhDs can understand, it's of absolutely no use to anyone. So I have almost 120 articles under that tab that are just reviews of the science with references. So if there are doctors who are listening or healthcare practitioners who are listening and you know, they want to know what's the science behind this. Go to my website, go to the Food for Thought tab. They're organized in terms of subject and they're all referenced and researched. That's where Dr. Fung really inspired me, that making the science available so that people can understand it. That's how I was changed. I was changed by having the science presented to me, not because, you know, it's almost like, you know, someone knocking at your door and saying you should believe in whatever they believe in, sign here and, you know, get baptized, or they'll sprinkle something on you, whatever. It's not, you know, we're not going to change what we believe as healthcare practitioners because someone tells us it's good. We're going to change it based on the science. So I changed my practice based on the science. I changed what I did based on the science. And there was a 2.5 year delay because I was a fat person.
You know what,
in denial.
Joy, it's funny that you mentioned that, and I've related to you, and you know, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I've related to your story about weight loss. And you know, my own personal approach mirrors yours exactly in that, you know, when I looked for a solution for myself, I went to the literature and I reviewed the literature. And when we review the literature, thousands of papers and books now that all are overwhelmingly supportive of low carb modalities for weight loss and for glycemia. Mm-hmm. And finally, you posted this fairly recently about the ADA finally kind of accepting low carb diets as a approach to managing glycemia. So I know that you're very, very research oriented, and I you know, and that's something that's drawn me to you. And you've actually done some interesting research about kind of ADHD. Can you talk about your research and talk about kind of diet with regards to behavioral issues, mental disease, mood disorders? Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They overlap. My research, my master's degree research was in the area of mental health nutrition, specifically ADHD and comorbid disorders, which include depression, anxiety, ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder, and OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. These tend to come in a cluster. And it's also somewhat related to bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, because they are thought to be a spectrum of disorders that have common genetic links and then different additional genes that are involved. But the specific research I did was with regards to diet and nutrition of children between the ages of 6 and 12 with ADHD. And I wanted to know what was the mechanism of that caused that was underlying ADHD. And of course, you know, back in the 60s, Feingold was all about sugar and red food dyes. And then nobody had touched ADHD research and nutrition since then. And so I was handling this huge hot, you know, hot potato, and nobody wanted to touch it. It's like, I want to know. As it turns out, I had three sons, twins and a singleton born 14 months apart, and they all had ADHD. And there are three subtypes of ADHD. And once they were diagnosed, they had one of each subtype. So for somebody not to do, with my background, not to do research when I had my own little study group at home, I wanted to know what was the underlying mechanism. And so I did about 2 years of lit review before I actually started to do my clinical research, and came to understand that ADHD, both both subtypes, the hyperactive and the just the inattentive, are linked to dopamine and norepinephrine. And so I did a lot of studying about those neurotransmitters, the effect on the brain, and of course, serotonin, which affects depression and other mood disorders, is one step away from dopamine. And matter of fact, they can interchange into each other through a pathway. So depression, which is a serotonin pathway, and ADHD and anxiety disorder, which are dopamine pathway, also impacted by norepinephrine, overlap. So I did my research, found conclusive evidence that there was a statistical difference between the ADHD kids in their intake of micronutrients related to precursors for the synthesis of dopamine and norepinephrine. But where it gets really interesting is there are a lot of studies to do with, now I did my research with Dr. Margaret Weiss, who is one of the founding researchers in Canada with respect to ADHD. She's published extensively, and she had come across research where a large percentage of people in morbidly obese clinics in England were diagnosed with ADHD in this study. And I was like, wow. So impulse control. I mean, we all know about kids who blurt things out. Oh, look, squirrel, you know, impulse control and food. And so this researcher had done quite a bit of research about people becoming morbidly obese because they were ADHD and you know, their ability of their brain to stop doing things, to put the brakes on, so to speak, wasn't working effectively. And after I published my research and got into this low carb thing, I guess probably almost 10 years later, maybe 8 years later, I was thinking, I bet there's something to do with low carb and dopamine, because people kept talking about how much clearer their thinking was getting when they would be, you know, on a ketogenic diet. And I was sure there was this dopamine link. And then I came across a study, which I actually wrote a blog on. And it's why fats and carbohydrates together in the same food have a super additive effect. And it's because they both trigger dopamine release in the brain. And dopamine is this wonderful neurotransmitter that is linked to feeling good. It's the runner's high. It, believe it or not, is the neurotransmitter that's released during sexual intercourse. So it's a pretty powerful hormone. And it is actually released when people eat carbs and when people eat fat. And when you put them together, it's exponentially higher than both of them individually. And I said, I knew it. I knew there was a link. And then when you stop eating these things, the whole mental clarity thing with the ketone, the brain running on ketones and things like this. So they actually ended up overlapping, which I thought was really cool.
Well, you know what's interesting on that too is a lot of times when people get too much of a hormone or too much dopamine, too much of a neurotransmitter, they downregulate the receptors. So, you know, a lot of times we're talking about is carbs being very addictive and people can't give up donuts, can't give up cake. And part of it may be the same thing as with cocaine. When people quit cocaine, they feel miserable for a year. So they relapse because they feel so bad, like they have the flu for a year, and they say, forget it. I'm going back to what I was doing. I felt better. And so is that the same type of thing we're finding when people are cutting out carbs for a little while, that it takes a little while for those receptors to start upgrading?
You know, I have never even thought of that. And you're absolutely right, because there is that down. Actually, it's very interesting because Jason Fung, how I ended up meeting him is he had posted something about ADHD in a blog, and I wrote him and challenged him that actually what he said about Ritalin wasn't correct. And then he was talking about downregulating and upregulating. Mm. He was the last person to mention that, and that's like 5 years ago. But that makes a lot of sense, because if we are constantly stimulating those receptors and overstimulating them, where it's like insulin resistance, they just shut down and, you know, say, you're overstimulating me. For sure, the craving for something to stimulate dopamine, and it wouldn't necessarily be carbs, because we do know, like in addiction research, that, you know, people will exchange one form of addiction for another. So people might take up drinking or smoking weed, which might sound funny, but weed actually releases dopamine. So a lot of people with ADHD end up, there's a high prevalence of marijuana use in ADHD because it works on the same receptors. I want to look at that more. I think you've raised a very interesting point that might be hugely helpful for people who have the addiction issues with food and weight, and there is this ADHD component.
Well, we see it, Brian. I know we see this all the time with cocaine abuse, that the dose required has to be greater and greater. And even in ADHD, I don't know, I don't deal a lot with kind of adolescents, but, you know, we're getting a lot more of kind of adult ADHD as it's diagnosed. And you know, I think it's often misdiagnosed, but you know, the doses they're requiring of amphetamines only goes up, and there's a big component of addiction, and to get that same effect, they're going, you know, they're needing more and more. But what I want to talk about and focus about for a second, and I know you probably feel very strongly about this, Joy, is, you know, how much diet impacts you know, the behavioral component of ADHD. You mentioned depression, how diet is such a strong component of managing depression. And you also mentioned OCD, trichotillomania, these things. Like, I know that there's a big component. I've seen research that's shown that there's nutritional deficiencies that when they're addressed, they resolve OCD to some extent. Mm-hmm. So I feel very strong. I know, Brian, you've probably seen this. You have a family coming to you for weight loss, a woman, a man, and you treat them for weight loss with a good, wholesome diet. And then they tell you, you know what, doc, my kid's behavior has improved. You know, how many times have you heard that? And so, you know, when you look at the data in the medical literature, it's all there that if you, you know, reduce additives, if you reduce artificial colors, if you put them on a whole food diet, that behavioral improves in ADHD, it improves depression. So can you talk a little bit about your clinical experience with that and kind of, not that it's a cure all, but that it's a big, strong component. Can you talk about that, Joy?
Well, I'd like to explain, to kind of back up for 1 second. I look at ADHD or clinical depression no different than needing to wear glasses. And you've probably seen pictures of me. I have these bright pink glasses. And so if I don't wear them, I will stub my toe and break it because I am blind. So my eyes don't work properly. And if I don't wear glasses, I can't see effectively. So wearing glasses to me to correct vision is no different than taking medication. And there's also non-stimulant medication for ADHD as well, such as atomoxetine and others that are norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors that aren't stimulant based at all. So not all medication for ADHD is stimulant based. But that said, there are some people, whether it's with depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, ODD, ADHD, who could really benefit by having medication. But that said, because there are specific neurotransmitters that are involved in the etiology of these disorders, and we know food affects the same neurotransmitters, it's a both and situation. For the same example, I'm a type 2 diabetic in remission, and I got in remissions on diet alone and recently started taking metformin because my father had was recently at 90 years old diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and I wanted to prophylactically take metformin to, add that protective element to the glucose metabolic dysfunction that's involved with Alzheimer's disease, also sometimes dubbed type 3 diabetes. So I'm not going to not take medication because diet works. In the same way with ADHD, I would never tell somebody with clinical depression or ADHD, oh, you don't need meds, just change your diet. But it's both and. They can complement each other. And I have definitely seen a reduction in the amount of medication, not just in my clients for metabolic disorders, as well as for mental health. I track my clients who take these medications as we go through the process of addressing diet. And I have them monitored for the amount of medication. And I have consistently seen the amount of medication they need both for depression, ADHD, as well as metabolic disorders being reduced. And in some cases, all of the medications are no longer needed. So definitely there is a complementary aspect that we can't treat something in the absence of something else. We really need to look at, is medication really effective and needed at this point in the person's disease state? And maybe it's something that can be reduced or withdrawn later. And I don't make a distinction from disorders that are from the neck down or from the neck up. I mean, we have the physician's desk reference and the PDR and the, my mind just went blank. Help me out with the mental health.
DSM 5 or 6 or whatever we're at now.
DSM. The DSM. Those are two books that have the diagnosis. And that's why we make this distinction. But disorders are disorders. And if it involves neurotransmitters, does it matter if it affects your stomach or how you think?
Well, Joy, that was a big surprise for me too, is the the fact that people felt so much better, they had a better sense of well-being, less stress, less anxiety. And I think a lot of it has to do with the hormonal aspects of, you know, we're going to argue for the next 80 years, whether it's calories in, calories out, all this kind of stuff. But I think the point is, there's no doubt in my mind that the hormonal aspects are the most important thing. If we can get those things stabilized, our body wants to have stability for survival. So when you have, you know, I'm reading studies that people are going hypoglycemic 3 to 5 times a day because they're eating so many, you know, high carb foods, and they're crashing afterward, then they're tired, then they need something else to lift them up. They, what would you say, Troy, the Skittles and the Red Bull diet that people are on? But that's a reality when you have stability.
It's helpful for ADHD, the Skittles and Red Bull diet. No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's super interesting.
You know what the funny thing is? The beginning part of my thesis was all about how sugar and red food dye is really only 3 to 12% of kids with ADHD. And now, knowing what I know now about the how sugar affects the brain and you know, pathways, I would, you know, I'm not going to, if I'm going to do a PhD thesis, it's not going to be in the area of ADHD, but I would probably have a different approach to writing off sugar as a potential exacerbator of behavior in ADHD than I did 8 years ago. I think it probably has a bit more of a role, not necessarily because of the dopamine norepinephrine thing, but certainly, you know, the effect on, you know, insulin and the rise and crash of insulin. So.
Yeah, no, that's a phenomenon we see. And, you know, kind of like Jason says also, is that, you know, after Thanksgiving dinner, if food's giving you all this energy, you should be out running around doing all this stuff, but everyone else is in a food coma. And I've noticed that too. I, you know, when I'm low carb or if I skip lunch, I don't get tired in the afternoon. My energy's up. And Troy, you're probably seeing the same type of stuff, right? Where you're just breaking down the fat around your liver and using it as an energy source and keep on plugging along.
You know what people find quite, I have this conversation probably every day with clients in my office, is I'll say, well, will I be hungry doing this? And I'll go, do you know when the last time I ate was? And this is, you know, 1 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock. And it doesn't matter when I say this, because it's always the same. I generally only eat one meal a day. I eat supper. And so I'll say the last time I ate was last night at supper. And all I do all day is talk about food.
Yeah.
And all I do when I'm not talking about food is write about food, post pictures of food, take pictures of food and cook food. And I'm not hungry. So if I'm not hungry and the last time I ate was last night, I think you're going to be okay.
That's really, I love that. You know, we talked about this, Brian, just very recently, with Dr. Sivas and Amy Berger. We talked about kind of the, non-hunger cues to eat and the addiction model of eating. And we've definitely talked about all of this, and you're absolutely right. Most people don't know what true hunger feels like. And when you come off of these foods, when you come off of these foods that really drive your hunger up artificially, you know, you really begin to feel like a satiety.
I didn't know what hunger was. I've got to tell this story because here I am, a registered dietitian, with lots of clinical experience and a master's degree. And I'm sitting where it must be about a year ago. And I was going, I feel something, but I didn't know what it was. It was a physiological feeling, but I didn't have a word for it. And I was going, I don't know what I feel. It's something in my stomach. I know what it is. I'm hungry. This is hunger. This is different than what I've been feeling for the last 8 years. Now 10 years, where you want to eat something, you're craving something, that's very different than hunger. I was physically hungry and I didn't know what that feeling was because it had been probably 10 years or 12 years. I mean, how long was I hyperinsulinemic before I actually got diagnosed as being diabetic and probably had overridden those cues for years. So probably 15 years since I felt real hunger. I didn't know what that feeling was.
Yeah, it's amazing. In America, and we don't know what hunger is. And we, you know, that's the thing is, we're stressed, so we eat, we're uptight, we had a hard day. And so we use food as a drug. And Robert Sivas, the first time I heard him say that, I thought, this guy is nutty. But he said, look, if you're addicted, if you're an alcoholic, that first beer is the most dangerous one because you're going to have 30 beers. Some people can have one beer and they're done. But yeah. Carbs are the same way when you're addicted. And he said, that's not a food. That's a drug. And he was making the point is, yeah, like you had said earlier, Joy, you substitute one drug for another, right? So you're trying to come off heroin. And, yeah. And so now you're taking whatever the next step is on methadone. So, you know, then people are on methadone for 30 years.
Forgot about Suboxone.
Suboxone now. Yeah, Suboxone. So, but the thing is, the whole plan is that has to be a bridge to come off of what you're hooked to, right? And so it's interesting when you start realizing, you know, because his point is, he says, snacking is always for the brain. It's not for your body because your brain wants something and you want to have.
Absolutely.
And so a lot of us in this, and I would love you to speak to this a little bit, is, you know, a lot of us doing low carb, and I've been guilty of this also, saying, you know, I'm going to eat macadamia nuts. I'm not eating french fries or potato chips, but I'm eating those kind of things. But you could eat macadamia. You could eat a ton of calories and fat in macadamia nuts and never lose a pound, right? So sometimes we're substituting. Or the other thing I'd like to hear your opinion on is, we do low-carb pizza, we do low-carb cake and low-carb, so we just take out the sugar, we do everything else the same, take out the sugar and the flour and substitute a different flour and a different sweetener. What's your feeling on that for someone who's really struggling? Sometimes it's mentally, it helps people, and it depends on the person probably.
I'm glad you asked these questions. I'm going to address them separately. And the one about the very high fat intake, and this is where clinically I ended up taking a slightly different approach than my original mentor, who's Jason Fung, takes, because he takes a very high-fat, adequate protein approach. But then realizing when Megan spoke at Low Carb Breckenridge, I understood that they offset that with the intermittent fasting, that a lot of people who are involved in their program can't necessarily eat low carb all the time. So, by combining the intermittent fasting with the low carb, high fat, they can, from an affordability issue, they're only eating half the time. So it's not an issue. I had a problem originally because I was the dietitian of recommending unlimited, you know, bacon and whipping cream and all these things. So I took, no one can go wrong with having high monounsaturated fat, you know, olive oil, avocado oil, avocados, fish oil, things like that. So that was the approach I took originally. But then the whole nut thing came up, and macadamia nuts, is a perfect example. Eating tons of macadamia, I wasn't losing weight. And I'm going, well, but macadamia nuts are, you know, keto friendly, right? Well, Dr. Eric Westman is another person who's influenced me a great deal. And he has the approach. I actually heard him speak when he was here in Vancouver about 5 weeks ago. And he said something shocking. No nuts, no fruit. And I had always had nuts and seeds on my salad and, a few berries on my salad. And I had my weight had plateaued for about 4 months. And I was like, he's the devil. That's awful. How can you say that? And I looked at him like he had 6 heads and 4 horns. And I said, well, what do I have to lose? Like, I know with my clients, some clients have come to me following a diet they got off Diet Doctor or from reading Dr. Fung's books and applying it without having necessarily the education with how to do the fasting with it, and ended up gaining weight. And I was like, well, I'm not gaining, but I'm not losing. So I know it's a lot of my clients, they don't do real well, especially women of a certain age, postmenopausal women don't do really well on the super high fat unless they're doing the intermittent fasting. And so I tend to use a higher protein approach, lower fat approach, and it works beautifully. And then transition like Finney and Volek do once they've lost the weight to increasing the fats and at that point. So unlimited fat, it works really well for young men. It works great for gym rats, young male gym rats, works great. It doesn't work really well for postmenopausal women, in my experience, who don't also do lots of fasting. And the issue of limiting protein to do that with older people, I'm more concerned about sarcopenia and some of the work that Stephen Finney has talked about this and Don Lehman, who's a professor emeritus in the United States. I have a series of articles on my blog about sarcopenia from lectures that he's given. I'm concerned about limiting protein in older adults. I'd rather have them have higher protein and lower fat because the ratio mix is more protective of their muscle mass, because the muscle mass is, and Tro's probably the expert in this with all his resistance training, that's where you're going to get a lot of the metabolic effect is from the muscle. You don't want to lose muscle. So I take a higher protein, lower fat approach, and don't encourage anyone except my really young male or female, super athletic clients, females as well, who are like super athletic, to do really high fat.
Yeah, I think that's a stumbling block for a lot of people. And I think people are chasing their ketones. So they're said, I eat way more fat and then my ketones go higher. Well, you're not losing weight. Your ketones are higher. Great. You know, you're throwing way more stuff into your system. And I agree. And I think the problem we run into, and part of the reason we're doing this podcast, is to reach those middle age or menopausal women who their husband loses 30 pounds and they lost 6 eating the same way. And it's exactly what you're saying. That's what I'm noticing too, is the guys will lose it super quick, but eating the same things, it doesn't work for her.
Yeah, exactly. And so I will often have a husband and wife. I often see couples and I often see families together. I have them all on a different mix. And I believe very much in individual nutrition. And I'm going to get back to the thing about the pizza and the baked goods, because that's important. But within the same family, within a couple, I will have them on different mix of protein and fat, depending on what their needs are, what their metabolic needs are. And we don't have to guess. We don't have to base it on glycemic index and glycemic load, which is for non-diabetics. If the people are diabetic, we can test how they react to particular carbohydrates. We don't have to guess. We can, you know, and I've done it myself and posted how I did it. We can, you know, if people want to eat, I don't know, chickpeas, and they want to have a half a cup of chickpeas because it makes them happy. Well, let's find out how you react from fasting to half a cup of chickpeas cooked from dry. And if your blood sugar stays reasonably stable, in my case, 2.5 years ago, it went through the roof. And now I eat half a cup of chickpeas cooked from dry, and my blood sugar doesn't move. So we can individualize nutrition for diabetics using glucometers or using continuous glucose monitoring if they test it from fasting. We don't have to guess. We can make it very individual. So
one of the messages you're conveying here, Joy, which I know that Brian agrees with, because we've talked about this many times, is, you know, there's so many people to help. You know, there's no absence of diabetics. There's no absence of obesity. And, you know, there's so many patients who are going to come to you and me and Brian, and all of us, and Jason Funk, we all have different approaches. And I think one of the key points you're saying now, which Brian has said many times in the past, is everybody is different, and that it requires an individualized approach. The fact that you're taking into account the different protein needs of different patients, and that you're taking into account the different fat needs of different patients. You know, this is not a one-size-fits-all approach. How fasting affects different people. And I know Brian agrees with me that, you know, this individualized approach and the fact that we all kind of see things differently is perfectly fine. You know, people, you know, right, Brian? I mean, I know we've talked about this in the past, that you feel strongly that, hey, look, we're all going to have different insights. We're all going to have different practices.
Yeah, I think that's critical, right? It's critical that so many times on Twitter, I see it like, oh, this guy's a zealot. He's a zealot. You're a zealot. You're called a zealot. And it's like, no, we don't use the same approach. No one's saying this is the only thing that works. But if you're 400 pounds and your sugars are 300, you cannot carb load. That's just the bottom line. I don't care who you are. But if you're a 23-year-old ultra marathon runner with it's all muscle, you can get away with all the carbs you want pretty much, at least as long as you stay metabolically healthy. So I think there's a spectrum, and we all have to look at that and say, okay, where am I menopausal? And what works for me? What doesn't? And we're smart enough to figure out, okay, I've been doing this for 2 months and I haven't lost a pound. Maybe I got to change a variable here somewhere, right? I'm not going to keep doing the same dang thing. So maybe I need to fast more. Maybe I need to go up on my calorie, whatever it is. So I think having you, Joy, know that and say, okay, this isn't working. What do we change? Just like if I have you on an antidepressant that's not working.
Yep.
We have to change the med, or we got to do something different.
Yes. You change the med.
Or change life.
Yeah, change the meds, change the dose, change the scheduling. It's exactly the same.
Change your sleep schedule. You know, this is stressing out every day. You know, all these things are key.
Sleep is a huge. Sleep and stress are the two things that are not talked about enough. Sleep affects your circadian rhythms. It affects your cortisol, which affects your insulin. So not sleeping enough, good sleep hygiene, and this is something that was part of my research as well, because ADHD people are notoriously have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. So addressing sleep hygiene is part of what I do in my practice. Also stress management. You know, if you're, you know, a type A personality, like I know Tro and I are, it's very obvious we're type A personalities. We have to work harder at relaxing, at making the gerbil on that little treadmill in our brain go to sleep. And so it's having good sleep hygiene is one thing. The other thing is being very conscientious about not taking on stress where we don't need to, not arguing with idiots on Twitter is a perfect example. Like we don't need the extra stress because that's going to increase our cortisol, which is going to increase our insulin. And the next thing you know, we're going to want a donut.
Yeah, I've been telling Tro that for a long time. He's starting to listen though, I think.
Yeah, I won't mention any particular names, but there's certain people Tro shouldn't argue
that's
with.
That's what it is, right? If you want to spike my blood sugar, you just say the name Lane Norton or, you know, or... Or you say the
name. Yeah, yeah,
you know,
I know. You know what? I'm going to give you some free advice, Tro. It's called blocking somebody. You don't need the aggravation. You don't. Let whoever it is believe whatever they want, because you're not going to save the world. And it's like we were just talking about a few minutes ago. We all of us take different approaches. People come to us because of the approach we take and they can relate to it. If people want to do a high fat approach like Dr. Fungus, they know where the IDM clinic is. People want to do it the way Tro's doing it, they know where to find it. People want to do it the way you're doing it, Brian, they know where to find you. You know, postmenopausal women and men of a certain age see my gray hair and go, I trust her, she's not too young. They come see me. There's more than enough people out there with different metabolic issues, but we don't need to aggravate ourselves trying to convince people who either call us zealots or call. Dr. Fung was talking about something the other day. People were saying that he was a snake oil salesman or something like that.
He actually has a side business doing that. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, this is important. You know, we asked Jason to come on as a guest and he said, you know, I really want to collaborate with you guys rather than being a guest. And he says, the first thing we have to really, said, ethically, we cannot have any corporate accountability where we have advertisers on. We're not going to click like if when we put your hopefully book coming out soon and your website, we have no financial interest in that. It's because we believe in it and we care. Right. And so you want to just divorce yourself from all those things. And I think that's critically important. And mm-hmm. You know, we did this whole podcast just so we could have an intervention with Tro, and I love it. We're going to get your OCD. Okay. He's got like, oh, you were mentioning all those diagnoses. I'm like, that's Tro, that's Tro, that's Tro. You got all the diagnoses, Tro.
Can I just put Glizzy?
Yeah.
All right. My Twitter persona may seem angry, but I'm like totally calm and, you know, I enjoy, you know, being a little antagonistic. It's the New Yorker in me. It's like, in fact, if you go to New York and you like say hello, how are you to somebody, they look at you like funny. What's your problem? Exactly.
What's your problem?
So, I'm very antagonistic on Twitter, but, you know, obviously people have heard me on podcasts. And, you know, somebody just wrote to me, you know, she's like, I listened to you on, you know, Sean Baker's podcast and you were so calm.
I was like, I saw that. I wanted to pipe in on that.
I was like,
Tro is super calm, good guy. He's a super great guy. And I saw that and I'm like, he's got a great story. He knows his stuff. He's smart. He's done things that I don't know anyone who's lost 150 pounds in 155. Sorry, Tro, he always corrects me. 155 pounds and kept it off for 3 years, right? Those last 5 pounds were the hardest ones. So he wants credit for that. But that's just reality.
I mean, don't you feel strongly, Brian? I know you feel this. You cannot stand, you know, idly by anymore. I cannot see people, you know, when I have a patient who's on 100 units of insulin a day and, you know, their doctors are being told, you know, telling them to carb load, I cannot, you know, just wait idly by. I cannot let people kind of give a false message. You know, and it's not, I have since blocked, you know, these people that, Alan Aragon is another, you know, if it fits your macros agitators that I've followed.
I don't have conflict with those guys, because they're basing their opinion on what they're seeing.
Correct.
And they're seeing athletes who work out six, like, you know, I can't do what Sean Baker's doing. I don't work out to this extent, right?
It's an athletic population. Correct. Absolutely.
So when you're dealing with metabolically healthy people, you could get away with all kinds of stuff. And the thing they're finding is my people who start out low carb, they lose 30 pounds and they'll come in and go, hey, guess what, doc? I'm having carbs like 5 days a week and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And I'm not getting any weight. I'm keeping an eye on that. I'm feeling pretty good, because now they're insulin sensitive. Now they could be like that 100-pound lady who could eat donuts and not gain weight. So we put ourselves into a better, but you know, that's why I tell my patients, hey, let's be strict at the beginning. And then if you want to loosen up, but take it seriously now. But if you're one of those people, like the alcoholic who has one beer and they go off the wagon, which is a majority of alcoholics, you have to realize I can't have that first beer and I can't have that first cookie and I can't have that first.
But there's another case that I'd like to bring up as an example that is my case. I started out low carb, 50 grams, then I went to 35, then I went to 30, then I went to 25, then I went to 20. And going to 20 grams was the only way to lower my blood sugar sufficiently that I could put myself into remission, partial remission of type 2 diabetes, and lower my blood pressure and get my lipids in a healthy state. It's 20 months this coming week that I've been doing this, and I can't add back in the carbs, and it has nothing to do with food addiction, because I really didn't have food addiction. That wasn't my issue. My issue was I'm metabolically sick, and I didn't become metabolically well by doing this for 20 months. I am just as metabolically sick as I was before. And if I eat 25 or 30 or 35 grams of carbohydrate, it affects my metabolism. My blood pressure goes up, my blood sugars go up. And so I don't have an option. For me to be metabolically healthy, I need to continue to do this. And I'm exercising, I'm lifting weights, I'm walking, I am doing all the things that I, you know, I'm practicing what I preach. But it's 20 months later and I am no more my insulin, my fasting insulin is down. Clearly I haven't done my insulin under a challenge, but by looking at my glucose, which is a reflection of that, I can tell that it's doing very well. But for me, eating a bagel or eating pizza, regular pizza, is not going to put me in a case where I'm going to crave every carb in sight. It's going to make me metabolically unhealthy again.
So what's your opinion going back? And I think that, it takes a while to fix that, as a matter of fact, I was talking to an obesity expert. And I said, what's the best management of diabetes in your opinion? Because I wanted to see what you're saying, low carb, high carb, whatever. And I thought about it and said, you know what? The best management is never getting obese in the first place. So that darn Jason Fung, right? He never got obese. So he didn't have to go through the stuff we went through. And he didn't have to go through the battle of getting metabolically healthy again, because he's kept himself metabolically healthy. So thin people, and that's what we're fighting. And that's what we're seeing, is that a lot of doctors have never struggled with weight. So they go, just do what I do and everyone's going to be the same. Well, that's the same mentality that Lane's going to have and different people are going to have, because that's what they see and that's what they experience. My point of view comes from my worldview, right? Because this is my worldview and this is what I see. I see sick diabetics getting amputations, and that's why I'm passionate. That's why Crow's passionate, because we don't want to see that happen to any one of our patients. And we can prevent that. And we know we can if we get the right patient population. And the people who say, look, I'm going to listen to Joy. I'm going to do these things, right? Because Joy, if you didn't change what you were doing, you'd be a total disaster right now, right? So the fact that you've maintained and you've lost weight, and it just says what you're doing is working for you. Right. It may not be what Tro needs to do, but it may be what, and I'm like you, I'm super insulin resistant. So I if I eat carbs, I gain weight.
None of my clients are as restricted in carbohydrates as I am. Nowhere close. I start everyone at a much higher level of carbohydrates, especially if they're on medication, get them stabilized and then lower it very gradually with doctor's oversight, because that's the way I choose to do it. I am so surprised that even with people who are insulin resistant or type 2 diabetic, very few of them need to go down to such a very low level of carbohydrate. If it's working at 50 grams, why put them at 20? If it's working at 100 grams, there's no need to put them at 75. If their blood sugars are coming down, their blood pressure is coming down, their hemoglobin A1C is coming down, their fasting insulin is coming down, it's not broken. Don't fix it.
Yeah. And so sometimes people will go off the way and say, forget it, it's too hard. And I try to walk that line, see what is acceptable to that person. I'm surprised at how many people come and say, you know what? Mm-hmm. doc, it's easy for me, instead of counting macros and doing all this stuff, I'll fast. And then I'll fast till dinner. I'll do this. They find out what works for them in their lifestyle, you know, because it's important for me to have dinner with my wife or to have breakfast on the weekend with my kids or whatever it is. So I say, okay, I'll just adjust my lifestyle to fit it. So I'll have a big breakfast that day and not eat dinner maybe. Whatever. I figure out what works for me because you don't want to be tortured. Oh, I can't have, you don't want to be that person who says, oh no, I can't have that. I can't do this. You know, because low carb, you can go out to any restaurant. I went out with Robert Seifus and Doug Reynolds from Low Carb USA. We had a great dinner and Pam, his partner, and we had a great time. And we had low carb and we were at a nice Italian restaurant and we figured it out and say, okay, we could have this, we could have that. We figured out and we had it was fun doing it because it was a challenge, but it was great. So I think, you know, so it's not not that difficult as we make it to be. And, you know, I wanted to step back one quickly. Well, I have two questions for you and then I'll just shut up. Sure. One, I want to go back to the, what do you think about substituting with the, it's probably an individual thing.
Ah, good. I'm glad you came back to that. I think, okay, let's do that one and hold your other question because who knows, maybe I'll forget where I'm going with it. It depends on who. People who have food addiction, people who were sweet, you know, people who always had to have sweets, I don't encourage them to make lots of keto sweets. I post recipes on, I have a recipe tab on my webpage for people, and it always says at the top, this recipe may or may not be suitable for your style of low-carb eating, because everybody's on a different mix. I have a New York cheesecake recipe tro that's to die for. It is so amazing. Yeah, I make it twice
exactly
a year.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Why? Because it's not the kind of thing that's going to do me a whole lot of good. It's super high in fat. It's very rich. And it's not going to help me in my goal to continue to lose weight. People who have food addiction issues shouldn't be, and this is where I think Tro and I agree, shouldn't be eating things that are sweetened, and it doesn't matter if it's with erythritol, stevia, you know, which at all, doesn't matter which all it's or sugar. It's because it's the brain that gets stimulated. It's the dopamine receptors that get stimulated. And I think people with food addiction, their brain doesn't care if it's sugar or it's erythritol. It's going to switch. It's the stimulation of the sweet receptors in the brain in those people, because it's addiction, is going to trigger those receptors and has nothing to do with how many calories or what happens to your insulin. So for those people, I say, stay away from it. It's, you know, it's like having somebody who's a former alcoholic shouldn't have non-alcoholic beer. It's not helpful, or non-alcoholic wine. And just get away from that lifestyle.
And the proximity in Trove talks about hyper palatable food that we just, you know, no one says, I'm going to go home and eat 3 pounds of broccoli. No one gets all excited all day thinking about that, you know, but if you're hungry, you can eat that. But, you know, and Robert Seifus says the same stuff. You have this stuff around your house, you're going to get weak. If you have alcohol around your house, sooner or later, you're going to be home alone and you're going to have a drink. It's the same thing if you have chips everywhere and you're going to rip those cabinets apart when you're crazy and eat them because you're hungry. So I think it's that kind of stuff. It's really knowing yourself, because you said, I'm an addict and I can't have it around and I know it. And so,
whereas for me, I don't have a carb addiction issue. I mean, there's certain foods, and actually there's two foods in particular that I know I could not, that I have a really difficult time limiting myself. One is a Montreal bagel cooked in a wood burning oven. And when I go to Montreal, or there's a place here called Siegel's Bagels.
Hey, New York bagels are much better. I'm just going to have to put that out there.
We're going to get into that. Someone from Montreal and someone from New York is never going to resolve this issue. So we'll agree. It's like pizza. We're not going to agree on that one either. Although New York pizza is the best in the world. Hands down, no question, you win. But I think Montreal bagels are the best.
But Brian, don't edit this, but we may have to edit it. I just endorsed a bagel on Low Carb MD. Oh, my God.
But you're supposed to be a zealot. What are you doing, man?
I had a friend come from Israel. It's a wonderful Arab friend of mine who came from Israel, and he said, I've heard all about these Montreal bagels. You got to take me for one. And so we took him to Siegel's Bagels, which is here in Vancouver, and we bought him a dozen bagels. And one of my three sons, who's went low carb with me 20 months ago, went with him, and he says, Mom, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to eat bagels when I'm there with Yahya, because he's going to be eating them, I'm going to be eating them. I took half a bagel. I ate it slowly. I enjoyed it. And I did not eat any more, because I knew if I ate more than that, I would eat
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing too, right?
And the same thing with pizza.
Yeah, to say, hey, look, I'm going to eat it. I'm going to enjoy. Like for me, it's chips and salsa and tortilla. I got fat on that, right? Because I could have chips and salsa. I could, you know, that's why I say, look, I don't go to Mexican food, but once every 3 months maybe, and then I'll have some chips and salsa and get it out of my system and I'll go crazy with it, right? But, you know, part of it's, look, if you're going to do that, give yourself some leeway. That's why I tell people, if you're going to, don't hate yourself and think you're a miserable person for a week and go off the rails. Say, okay, I went out, we had a good time, I'm done. Back to the reality. I'll fast tomorrow morning if I feel that bad about it. Not hate yourself. Or do whatever you want to do to compensate, right?
It's only going to be a sustainable lifestyle if we don't have hard and fast rules about you can never have. It's how much and how often.
Yeah, and Joy, we want to have you back, so I don't want to keep you too long. But my question that's been burning is, what happened in the medical community when you started recommending this kind of diet to people? Because I know what Tro and I went through, which is nothing compared to what Gary Fetke and Tim Noakes. But did you get a lot of sideways looks? Or did people kind of say, hey, you're doing it yourself, it's working, you know, I trust you? Or what was that like?
Crickets.
Crickets, huh?
Crickets. I am very grateful for the sound of crickets. Watching what Tim Noakes went through and witnessing what Gary Fetke went through and seeing what some of my Canadian colleague physicians who were reported to their colleges went through, I love the sound of crickets. I hope the sound of crickets continues. However, if you go on Twitter today, I got mouthy yesterday. Diabetes Canada posted because it was Diabetes Awareness Month. And I bit my tongue till it bled and said, no, I'm going to say something. I said, you know, the American Diabetic Association and the European Association for the Study of Diabetes approved a low-carb diet for medical nutrition therapy for type 2 diabetics. When will Canadian diabetics have the same choice? And I posted
That's true. And
on Diabetes
now, right?
Canada wall. I know that's sticking my neck out, but the evidence is there. Diabetes Australia has already approved a low-carb diet for use in type 2 diabetics. American Diabetes Association, the European Union now approve it as medical nutrition therapy, which means it can be prescribed in the United States. You guys can prescribe it for adult type 2 diabetics. But my question was, is the evidence is there. When are diabetics in Canada going to have the same opportunities as American diabetics? The disease is the same. So I may hear something more than crickets now.
Yeah, and I think that's what happens. We heard crickets. We heard, you know, sideways looks or saw sideways looks from my partners. And now they're asking me, hey, so how does this low carb work? What's keto? What does this mean? What is that? Someone can, hey, this guy's LDL went up. What do you think? I know his HDL went way up and his triglycerides cut in by 2/3. And so when you start just saying, hey, look, I know what I'm talking about. Well, I've looked at the data and we have clinical experience here. Now people kind of take you more serious than some quack, really. Yeah. We were going to call this the Keto Quack podcast because, you know, that's really because, you know, but people wouldn't understand. But the point is, you know, when you do something different, when you realize the standard of care, like you realized in your own life, so did I, so did Tro, we were doing the standard of care and we were getting worse every day and our patients are getting worse every day. So that's when you say that you take these strong stands on Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is. Guys, look, we have experience here. You have a different worldview. You have a different experience. This is what we've dealt with for the last 14 years. You know, we've watched our patients go through all these horrible things. And if we can prevent it, let's do it now before it's too late. And our healthcare system can't handle it. And, you know, so we're realizing, hey, if we can take, you know, that guy was telling me about, he was on $1,000 worth of medicine. Now he's on zero.
I saw that.
Every
That's
month.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Right?
Yeah.
Zero. No meds. Nothing. His mood got better. His blood pressure's normalized. Everything's gotten better for this guy and his life is great. And it's not about the money necessarily, but it's like, what are we doing for our patients? And I'm willing to have you think I'm nutty for a little while until you look at the data and you understand what I'm saying. And we'll stand in the gap. And you know, we've had people, fortunately, like you and like all these great people we've mentioned already, that stood in the gap and said, well, I'll take the heat, but I'm right. I'm not. And if they knew, if they didn't take the stand, it would be us getting the, you know, all these going through all the stuff that they went through. But now they've set a precedent for us and that we can talk about what we're talking about, you know? So, you know, super happy to have you on. I love what you're doing. And I, you know, your website is unbelievable and we'll put a link to it. And how do people get in touch with you, Joy, if they want to talk to you about, consulting with you or just, hearing about what you have coming out in the future and what you're doing now?
The best way is through my webpage, which is LCHF for low carb, high fat, hyphen RD for registered dietitian.com. So LCHF hyphen RD.com. And there's a contact me form right there. You can fill it out and send me a note and say, I heard your podcast or I have a question. There's tabs on my webpage with, you want to read Under Food for Thought is all the academic articles fully referenced. There's recipes. You can read about my approach. But if people want to contact me, that goes directly to my email and I will write you back from my personal business email. And I haven't posted anything about the book yet. That should be once I hear back from my publisher in terms of time, dates and stuff like that. There'll be some information about that, but I'm taking it even a step further. Helping people who are pre-diabetic avoid diabetes, helping people with type 2 diabetes reverse their diabetes is awesome. I want to keep people from ever developing pre-diabetes. The approach that I'm taking in my book is to help people identify what is going wrong metabolically the 10 or 12 years before their blood sugar even starts to become abnormal. And so this is the focus of my new book. If I can prevent people from becoming metabolically unwell before their blood sugar even starts to spike, I will feel like I won the lotto.
That's awesome. Troche's trying to put us out of business. We're not going to have all those sick people, but maybe we could take a vacation or something.
We can all go find something else to do. Think about it. Think about the idea of people never ending up pre-diabetic, which shouldn't be called pre-diabetes. It's really end-stage hyperinsulinemia is what it is. Let's call it what it is.
Absolutely. Tro, do you have any final parting words for us of wisdom?
Thank you so much for coming on, Joy. I'm a huge fan of yours, and your recipes are just amazing. And thank you again for coming on. I know you're going to help a lot of people. Continue to help a lot of people, and keep doing what you're doing.
And you guys too. I think you're both amazing. And Tro, I've got your fat picture on my desktop of my computer, and I show it to a lot of people. Say, look, it's not just me. Look at this guy, and they're like, what? The picture I love the best is you in your lab coat with your, I guess he's your eldest son, looking up at you, and it's just like,
yeah, it's crazy
well,
stuff.
Thank you.
Well, let's not give him a bigger head. But hey, everyone, thank you for sticking with us. This is super important stuff, and we thank you for listening. We greatly appreciate it, and hopefully you're getting some information, some news, some nuggets here that are going to help you out. Take what helps and leave the rest. But I think with Joy, a lot of this is going to help more than stuff you're going to leave behind. And so we're just super excited and hope people are going out for walks and doing stuff with their family and listening to this stuff or on long car rides and just having a better, healthier life. And we're just honored to be a part of that.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Joy. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to the Low Carb MD podcast. We hope you learned something of value today. Please remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and Stitcher, as this will help us to get the word out. Please consider supporting this project through a small donation through Patreon. Every penny helps. Until next time.